Daniel, Chapter 3. The fifth talk in a series on Daniel was presented by David Crabtree on May 17, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 5, Daniel, Chapter 3, accompanies this talk.
Hi, everybody. A virtual welcome to all of you. A welcome to virtual Reformation Fellowship. There were a couple of questions from last week, so I'll respond to those quickly, and then we'll get into this week's material. One question from Jan was, why was Daniel threatened with punishment along with the other wise men? The training that Daniel was receiving, the 3-year program, that was essentially a program that trained him to become one of the wise men. So he would have become what they call a Chaldean. And so what Nebuchadnezzar decided to do was, since the wise men were not able to tell him what he dreamed and then reinterpret it for him, he was going to punish the whole lot of them. That's a punishment policy that's common among soccer coaches and football coaches and other people of that ilk. So he's just gonna punish all of them. We could see last week, and we'll see it again this week, and there are other indications of it, that Nebuchadnezzar is a very emotional man and has a very bad temper. And when he's upset, he's very upset, and something's going to happen. He is prone to extreme punishments. We'll talk about that at the end, in the conclusion. I want to talk about that a little bit. But what we saw last week was he wanted to have a punishment for the whole group, for the violations, for the failures of apparently the few. The second question was, can we put names to the empires represented by the different medals in the statue? It really appears to me that we are not encouraged to do so. The only two empires in the statue as a whole, the only two empires that we really have much information about, is the first one, which is gold, and is identified with Nebuchadnezzar himself. So we know what that is. So we're told that. The other one is the last one. And what we know about the last one is it's tough. It crushes everything, but it's also not cohesive. So that's what we know about the last one. Otherwise, the ones in the middle, we don't get any specifics about them. The only thing is we know that as you go down the statue, they become less precious. So I don't think that we are really encouraged in this vision to attach specific empires to any of the different medals except the first one. And I think the reason that the first one, we have something concrete attached to it, that is, it's Babylon. I think the reason for that is because that helps us understand what each of the metals stand for. What is the kind of thing that is evolving over time? And it is a Babylon that is evolving over time. That's the fact that we don't have the information to be able to attach names to the different metals, I think, is very important, because I think that's a clue that what that vision is about in chapter 2 is not really predictive in the sense that we usually think of it. it's not giving us a prediction, a detailed prediction that we can attach current events to. It is really just charting out the trajectory of empire. And that's, I think, what it wants us to focus on. What is the natural progression of an empire? What's it going to do? What does it tell us? What is its end? And that's what's really critical. And there, what we see is, it is, empire is headed towards dissolution. It is headed towards lack of coherence, lack of cohesiveness, and destruction, being demolished and turned to dust. That is what it's headed towards. It is very temporal. And that's critical. Now, we'll look at other visions later on in Daniel, where we can start attaching names to some things. And the text really leads us in that direction. But in chapter 2, I don't think that it's doing that. All right, so those were the two questions that I got after I was done last week. Where are we in the book of Daniel? We're going to be looking at chapter 3. In chapter 2, as you'll recall, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. The Chaldeans, his wise men, were unable. Nebuchadnezzar insisted that the wise men tell him what his dream was and then interpret it. They were unable to do that. But Daniel was able to do that. Daniel told him what his dream was, and then he interpreted it to him. And in that dream, there was a statue. It was made of different metals. It was eventually destroyed and became reduced to dust by a kingdom, by an eternal kingdom that replaced it and grew to fill the whole world. Nebuchadnezzar learned from that he was the head of gold. And in the vision, then, that head of gold, that's the best state of empire. It deteriorates over time as you go down the statue. He also learned that empire was temporal. It was all going to be destroyed. And its vulnerability was its lack of cohesiveness. So that lack of unity was the Achilles heel of that statue. So that's what Nebuchadnezzar learned. I think Nebuchadnezzar thought about this vision. He knew that he had received it from a god, knew that this was important stuff. I think he took it to heart. And that's what brings us the events of chapter 3, and I'll talk about that more later. When did the activity of chapter 3 happen? There are no indications in the text as to when the date is. So anything trying to attach a date to it is pure guess, and so I'll make a pure guess. The only thing that I see that points really in any direction is I think that the dream was firmly in Nebuchadnezzar's mind when the events of chapter 3 take place. So it could be that this occurred relatively soon after chapter 3. But it could be that having a dream that's given to you by a god is something that you remember for a long time. So it's possible that this happened several years after chapter 2. But if I were to venture a guess, I guess it was around 600, relatively soon after the events of chapter 2, which occurred in 604. But that's a guess. My plan of attack for going through this chapter is I'm going to work through the first half of the chapter, just pointing out some of the features, important features of the text. And then I'm going to stop for a little bit, and I want to talk about how to make sense of what's going on in the chapter, why I think what's happening is happening, and in particular, what is the significance of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar sets up. Then we'll go through the rest of the events described in the chapter. We'll work through the rest of that text. And then at the end, I've got a few concluding remarks. So let's jump in. Daniel 3, verses 1 through 2. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Nebuchadnezzar had a huge statue set up. It's huge in that it's very, very tall. It's surprisingly small around. I was trying to figure out how to illustrate the proportions of this thing, and so I used my mechanical pencil to see how it compared, and except for the pointy top, which I don't think Nebuchadnezzar's statue had, this is approximately the proportions of the statue. So it's just a pole. It's very high, 90 feet high, but it's not very far across, not very big around. It's not clear what this is an image of. It's by image, I assume it's an image of a known thing. It seems to me, in all likelihood, it's an image of a person, but we don't know that. If it is a person, obviously it's very stylized because these are not the proportions of a person. It's all out of gold. Now, people have argued, well, if you have a statue that big, that would take an awful lot of gold, and it probably isn't all out of gold. And I don't know. That could very well be. But it would not be uncommon for it to be a statue that is made out of some other material and then covered with gold, gilded in gold. That was done very commonly, very often. So I don't know. I don't know whether it's solid gold or just gilded with gold, but the appearance is of all gold. It was placed on the plain of Dura. The plain of Dura is thought to be an area just outside of Babylon. It is a flat area, so this would be visible from a long ways away, and that's apparently why it's so tall, so that it can be seen from a long distance away. Nebuchadnezzar has this built, has it set up, and then he holds a dedication ceremony for this statue. And we have this long list of government administrators that are invited to attend, and then we have that list repeated saying that they were there. Clearly, the long list suggests that there were a lot of government officials that were there. Nebuchadnezzar wants complete buy-in by his government servitors into this, whatever he's doing with this statue. He wants them to set a model of behavior for everyone else. Verses 4 through 7. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Okay, so a herald makes an announcement on behalf of the king to all the government servitors that are there present on the plain of Dura. But presumably there are other people there as well, because it refers to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that are supposed to worship this thing. So there must have been other people there as well. So we've got representatives of the entire empire that are present here at this dedication ceremony. Everybody is supposed to fall down and worship when they hear the music played. What music is being played, we don't know, but we have a whole list of instruments. And that list of instruments is repeated. I talked about last week how there's a list a whole list that was repeated, and we get these lists in this chapter as well. And that the repetition of the lists, I think, for in each instance, it has a reason why they're repeated. The instruments, interestingly, are mostly foreign instruments. According to the scholars, the names of these instruments are all foreign, except for possibly one. One of them might be a native Babylonian instrument. But the others are apparently all from either Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey, or they're from Greece. So this is a multi-ethnic band. So when they hear the music of this multi-ethnic band, they are supposed to fall down and worship the statue. And we have people from all over the empire, every language, every people. They're all supposed to bow down to this. The punishment for those who refuse, who fail to do this, is that they will be burned alive. I just got in my notes to note the repetitions. The bureaucrats who are there, that list is repeated twice. The list of people that are supposed to bow down, that is repeated twice. And the list of instruments is repeated twice. And that all adds emphasis to each of those. One of the commentators that I looked at, he says it gives a comic feel to it. And I mentioned last week how it had kind of a comic feel to it. And these repetitions, I think there's a sense in which they do add kind of a comic feel to it. Verses 8 through 12. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." The NIV says at this time some astrologers, but the word there is Chaldeans. They just elected to translate it as astrologers. The term Chaldeans can be either an ethnic term referring to the dominant ethnic group in Babylon, or it can be a technical term for wise men, because the Chaldeans were famous for their knowledge of and use of the occult. And I use that as a technical term. That is the science of the unseen. So these astrologers, and I think astrologers is probably the right translation for here. They're coming as wise men. They're coming to the king as wise men. And they're bringing this charge against the Jews. In particular, it's the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those three did not worship the statue when the music played. And the Chaldeans choose to represent this refusal to bow down to the statue as an act of insubordination. It's a challenge to the authority of Nebuchadnezzar. So they've made it personal, and they've elevated it to a very sinister level. These astrologers are probably using this as an opportunity to eliminate these rivals for power. They're snitches, and I'll talk about that in the end, in the conclusion. But it's probably jealousy that's involved, because it points out these are people that he has set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar has put them in a high position, and nevertheless, they didn't bow down to the statue. That's what's so terrible about this. So jealousy is probably involved. I wonder if there isn't a little bit of anti-Semitism involved in it as well, given that verse 8 says, they came forward and denounced the Jews. So I suspect that there might be some anti-Semitism involved. They address the king with the standard phrase. We saw it in the last chapter, O king, live forever. Now, I suspect that's just the standard way to address the king when you come and are in his presence. But as I pointed out in the last chapter, it takes on kind of an ironic significance. Here, I think it takes on the flavoring of flattery. They want to flatter the king so that they can get the kind of response that they want. And the kind of response that they want is for him to execute the three Jews. But it is possible that the author is recording this because it suggests that the Chaldeans want to encourage Nebuchadnezzar further down the path that he has begun, that they want to encourage him to think in terms of making his empire eternal. And I'll talk about that more later. It is significant that the penalty that the king pronounced for this was a severe one. Whoever fails to bow down and worship the statue is supposed to be thrown into a fiery furnace. They're going to be burned alive. So it's not just a slap on the wrist for this violation. It's serious. And that's what these Chaldeans want to happen to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is particularly heinous given the fact that Daniel and his friends were the ones who made it possible for the other wise men, to escape punishment in chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar had decreed that all of the wise men be put to death. Daniel, as part of his agreement to tell Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was and interpret it, he asked that the wise men not be put to death. So it's due to Daniel's action on their behalf, that they were not killed in chapter 2. And here, that makes this a striking lack of gratitude on their part to now come after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The astrologers claim in their accusation of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that they pay no attention to Nebuchadnezzar. There's no reason to believe that they pay no attention to Nebuchadnezzar. It's true that they didn't bow down before the statue, but that's not the same thing as they pay no attention to Nebuchadnezzar. So they have exaggerated the wrong done. They have exaggerated what has happened in order to make a stronger case that these three need to be executed. They want to make Nebuchadnezzar angry. They want him to be involved personally. Take this as a personal affront and make sure that he carries out the punishment that he had promised that he would do. In fact, there's no reason to think that the three are trying to undermine Nebuchadnezzar's authority. They are rather conscientious objectors. And one of the questions that this chapter raises is there room in Babylon for conscientious objectors? Verses 13 through 15. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" So Nebuchadnezzar, as the text says, he was furious with rage. Nebuchadnezzar was very angry. Nebuchadnezzar is a hothead. We've seen indication of that before. We see it here. So he brings the three before him, and he gives them another chance. He's going to have the multi-ethnic band play its music again, give them another chance to bow down before the image. And he threatens them, "If you don't do it this time, I will definitely throw you into the furnace. And what god can deliver you from our hands?" In other words, Nebuchadnezzar is looking at the situation. He's saying, there is nothing that could be done that would prevent me from taking these three and throwing them in a hot furnace and frying them to death. It's just inconceivable to him there could be any intervention, even intervention by a god, that could prevent him from carrying out this punishment. From what follows in the latter part of this chapter, and from what we saw in the first two chapters, my suspicion is that Nebuchadnezzar is actually a bit sympathetic with these three. That he gave them the extra chance because he didn't really want to carry this punishment out. So I think there is a certain amount of sympathy for them on the part of Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't completely hate them, and he hopes that they'll comply so he doesn't have to. But on the other hand, he can't allow dissent, especially on such an important matter. And we'll talk more about that in the conclusion. Verses 16 through 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the god we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." A very brave response on the part of the three. They don't even need to go through the playing the multi-ethnic band music. We can forego all of that. They just say, "We don't need to defend ourselves before you." I think that it is clear to them that this is not a situation in which an argument can really be made, a defense can really be made. Nebuchadnezzar is not going to listen to any defense. He's in no mood for a defense. And they can sense that. He's worked up into a frenzy. So they're saying, "We aren't going to make a defense, and we don't need to make a defense to you. Our judge, the relevant judge here, the judge that counts, the judge that is significant here, is God. And if you decide to throw us into the furnace, God can save us. He's capable of doing that. But if he doesn't, it doesn't matter. They still are not going to serve Nebuchadnezzar's gods or worship the image that he has set up. Doesn't matter what the penalty is, they are not going to do it." Okay. So they're confident that under these circumstances, God will hold them blameless. And God is a lot more important than Nebuchadnezzar. And therefore, they'll take their case to God. They don't need to make their case to Nebuchadnezzar. All of this response, I'm sure, just made Nebuchadnezzar more angry. He doesn't acknowledge that higher court that they're talking about. From his perspective, that's ridiculous and offensive to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, Baldwin says with respect to this passage, they, that's the three, do not doubt the power of their God to deliver them from the king's furnace, but they have no right to presume that he will do so. All right, I want to stop here and look back at all that and what's going on and how I put this stuff together. Why did Nebuchadnezzar set up this image? Many commentators think that this is an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself, and therefore that what's happening is an act, an extreme act of arrogance. I don't doubt that this is an extreme act of arrogance. I just don't think that this is actually a statue of Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think it's intended to be a statue of Nebuchadnezzar. I think that this is a statue that was inspired by the vision that he had in chapter 2. I think chapter 2 and chapter 3 are closely tied together. They're right next to each other. And I think we're encouraged right from the beginning of chapter 3 to see it as connected with chapter 2. Why do I think that? Because chapter 2 begins with Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. And that comes right after the vision in chapter 2, in which we have a statue that the head of which is gold. And this statue that Nebuchadnezzar has made is all gold, whereas in the vision it was different metals of decreasing preciousness as you go down the statue. This one is all gold. This one never gets to iron and clay. So this one is the statue from chapter 2 the way it should have been, the ideal chapter 2 statue. And in the vision, the lack of cohesiveness that was there seemed to suggest that there were some kind of ethnic or cultural divisions within that last empire, the one that gets hit with the rock and brought down. And in chapter 3, there's a lot of emphasis on the multinational buy-in that's necessary for this statue that Nebuchadnezzar has made and set up. So he's eliminated that lack of cohesion in his statue that was a weak spot. So I think what he did is he reflected on the vision that was given to him by God in chapter 2. And he decided that is an important vision. It has an important message for me. It is reliable, as Daniel said it was. And I'm going to do something about it. Because what that image did is it revealed to me the vulnerability of empire. And I can overcome that vulnerability. I can fix it. That lack of cohesion, that's something I can fix. So Nebuchadnezzar wants the destruction of empire. He wants to keep that from happening. Now it's possible that Nebuchadnezzar saw that vision as a warning to him and an encouragement to actually fix it. And that's possible. Another possibility is he saw that was what the end of empire was going to be, that the end of empire was going to be destruction, complete destruction. And he has decided that he is going to cheat the fates. He's going to keep that from happening. He's going to take action to prevent that fate from being realized. My hunch is that latter is the case. That seems to be more fitting in the bigger biblical narrative, but I don't know for sure. So the image then that he is setting up on the plain of Dura, it really has two different significances. One is that image represents the unified empire of Babylon. That's what he has set up on the plain of Dura, is a symbol of this unified, cohesive, all gold, excellent empire. But it's also the means to unification. If everyone bows down to this thing, if everyone sees this as central to their lives, then that can provide the kind of unification that's necessary to avoid the fate that was predicted in chapter 2 in that vision. So I think what's going on is Nebuchadnezzar wants to unify his empire by requiring everybody to worship an image that represents the unified effort, the empire that they have created. So he wants to make an empire. He wants to turn Babylon into an empire that is invulnerable and eternal. Furthermore, I suspect that the reason that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not bow down to this is not just that it's a violation of the Mosaic law of worshiping idols and all that sort of thing. I mean, that could be the reason. That could be the only reason that they didn't bow down to it. My suspicion is, though, that they understood better what was going on. They were high-ranking officials. They knew all about the vision. They would have known all about it from Daniel and the interpretation of it and Nebuchadnezzar's response to it. They know all that history. And so I think that they have put two and two together, and they understand what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to accomplish by setting up this statue. So this is not just an idol. They are being asked to worship the empire and worship man's efforts to make himself and his works eternal. And all of that is abhorrent to them. And they will have no part of it. So that's what I think is going on here. I think that's how this ties in with chapter 2. Now, understand that I'm linking these chapters together very closely. And if they shouldn't be linked that closely, then the way I'm interpreting it is too speculative. But I think they're really supposed to be tied together. And if they're really closely tied together, this is what comes out of it, it seems to me. The next section, Daniel 19 through 23. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar carries out the punishment that he had said. Not only carries it out, but he was mad. He became even more angry at them because of their defiance of his orders and the way they responded. It really made him mad. So he has the furnace turned up 7 times hotter than usual. So they're really cooking this thing. And he has his soldiers grab them, tie them up, and throw them into the furnace. And in so doing, these men are killed. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't care all that much about his soldiers. In this section, Nebuchadnezzar's facial features are mentioned, and they change. So this is a very graphic passage, and it has more detail of Nebuchadnezzar's body language than any other chapter in order to tell the story that the author wants to tell. I think that Nebuchadnezzar was personally hurt by the fact that the three were completely unapologetic. They didn't even try to defend their actions. And I think he took that personally, as the Chaldeans wanted him to take it personally. He did, I think. And their intransigence then caused him to become very, very angry. And if my understanding of the significance of the statue is right, then it was unity that he was trying to bring about, and it's unity around the worship of this image of the Babylonian Empire. And unity requires 100% control, 100% conformity. So their action is subversive in a sense. I pointed out before that I think he probably personally kind of liked these three. And that's part of what plays into this, because he sees it as a personal betrayal. They have received a privileged status in Babylonian society. And now for them to not bow down and worship this image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up, I think he sees as an affront to him personally. But it could also be an indication of Nebuchadnezzar's insecurity. I mentioned last week that it appears to me that Nebuchadnezzar was, it says he was, his mind was troubled, and that's when he has the dreams. Why was he troubled? And it could very well be that he's insecure in his position as the new king, because new kings were always insecure in their positions, and because there was some unrest in the western part of his empire that he would have known about. So he's insecure. He seems to be insecure with respect to the Chaldeans. I think he isn't positive that they fully support him. And now Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he's not sure that they are actually supporting him. So that seems to be playing into this scenario as well. Okay, the three are tied up, and they are thrown into this furnace. Next section, 24 through 27. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw in the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. This must have been an incredible scene that would have left a big impact on everybody there. So it begins when Nebuchadnezzar is watching this and he leaps to his feet. So obviously something has really gotten his attention. And his leaping to his feet in the text, in the narrative, seems to signal a change in Nebuchadnezzar himself and his attitude towards what's going on. And we'll see it does change radically. He asked his officials for verification of what had happened. Isn't it right that there were three that were in? And aren't there four now? And aren't they walking around? And aren't they untied? And all that sort of thing. And all of that is confirmed. He's not seeing things. That's something that they all see and can verify. And one of them looks like a son of the gods. Interesting phrase to use. So he calls them out of the furnace. Now, I have no idea how they're coming out of the furnace. I don't know whether they were shut into this thing or I can't visualize it. I don't know how to think of what it looks like. But he calls them out. And he refers to them as servants of the Most High God. So he's recognizing that this was not even a typical God action. This is the Most High God, and probably only the Most High God who could have pulled off such a feat. The three come out. There's no mention of the fourth. We don't know what happens to the fourth. But the three come out. And as they're all crowded around him, all the Chaldeans, I don't know if all of them, but a bunch of Chaldeans are there, and Nebuchadnezzar is there, and officials, government officials are all there. And they're surrounding the three. And as they see, their clothes are not burned. They don't smell like smoke. And their hair is not even singed. So they have been completely protected by this extremely hot fire that they were thrown into. All of this means that there were a lot of witnesses besides Nebuchadnezzar to this incredible event. Verses 28 through 30. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar's attitude towards them has completely changed. He threw them into the fire because that kind of disobedience, that kind of insubordination could not be tolerated in Babylon. Now he praises them, and he praises their God. "Praise be to the God of these three who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's," that is my, Nebuchadnezzar's, "command, and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Before, it had appeared as though this kind of person, the kind of person that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are, who have a higher loyalty, they cannot be tolerated in the Babylonian Empire. That's the way it appeared to him. But now he's having second thoughts. No, this kind of person can be in our midst and ought to be in our midst. So he's actually praising the three for their steadfast commitment to this higher loyalty. That's an amazing turnaround for Nebuchadnezzar. They trusted God, they risked their lives, and they didn't back down. And now that's a good thing. So Nebuchadnezzar issues a decree. Anyone who disses Yahweh will be torn limb from limb and their house destroyed. We've seen that's kind of his default punishment. Tear them apart and bulldoze their houses. So that's what will happen to anyone who disses Yahweh now, because only Yahweh can save like this. This was an incredible thing that he witnessed, and it's only the one true God that could do this. And he sees from this that God is a saving God. That's an interesting observation on his part. Once again, when he says this, God is a saving God, it falls short of the total recognition of who God is. And we'll see in the next chapter that's true, that Nebuchadnezzar hasn't really come to terms with who Yahweh is. Nebuchadnezzar then causes the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to prosper. He elevates them to a high position in his empire. This is the kind of person he wants in authority now. Okay, I've got a few comments that I want to make, and then we'll dive into some questions. This story shows a huge reversal in fortunes. Nebuchadnezzar, in this chapter, he goes from being a cruel tyrant to a chastened but happy ruler at the end of the chapter. He's completely transformed. The Chaldeans, they go from respected supporters of the realm to looking like complete fools. And the three Jews go from being criminals subjected to a cruel punishment to being honored and loyal, even exemplary functionaries. So it's a great story of a reversal of fortunes when it looked like that was not possible. Within it, there are a few insights into empire that I would like to point out. And I think this is significant for the book of Daniel as a whole, because that's part of what's going on here, is laying out what is the nature of empire. And we're seeing it through the narrative. We're seeing some features of empire. I want to make three observations that come from this chapter. The first is that empire in its ideal form. When I'm using empire, and in my notes I capitalize it when I'm using it this way. Empire is this thing that develops quite naturally. If you put human beings in a group over a long enough period of time, the natural development is going to be empire. And empire is that Babel-like thing, the thing that developed in chapter 11 of Genesis. It's that kind of effort to come together, unify all of their efforts into a tight-knit, unified collective. And if they can do that, unite all their efforts together, then they can provide for the security of the whole group, the security and prosperity of the whole group. And it's that end towards which empire with a capital E naturally tends to go, made up of sinful human beings. Given enough time, that's where it's go. That is its telos. That's what it wants to develop into. Empire, in that sense, it results in the idolization of the collective, of the society. Because what they're trying to do is harness the resources of everyone towards a common goal. And that common goal is security and prosperity. Their prosperity is just an extension of security. It's just better security. The unity of effort and purpose is absolutely critical to success. Everybody has to be on board. Everybody has to be working in lockstep in order to pull this off. So, security and prosperity of all depends on the cooperation of all. That's the bargain that's made in empire. We will obey, and it the empire will keep us secure. In empire, everyone is encouraged to look at the collective as the main source of safety and prosperity. That is to say, when push comes to shove, where does one turn for security? It's to the collective. It's to the empire. It will save us. And ultimately, it alone will save us. We all have lots of things that we turn to for safety in different kinds of situations. Our house is a form of safety. Our bank account is a form of safety. Our insurance policies are a form of safety. Our friends are a form of safety. We've got lots of places that we turn for safety in different kinds of situations. But what we're talking about here is the phenomenon that one thing takes precedence over another when we're faced with various circumstances as to where we turn for safety. We will turn to one thing over another thing for safety in certain kinds of circumstances. We'll turn to another thing for security in another kind of circumstance. And as our life progresses, we see what it is that we turn to in those really critical situations for safety. Whatever it is that is the ultimate thing that we turn to for security, that's what the prophets refer to as the rock. That's what Isaiah uses the term for. The rock, that thing which is solid, that thing which is stable, that thing that we can always count on. That is our ultimate source of security. That's our rock. Empire wants its subjects to see it, that is the collective, as the rock. And whatever is the rock, that's what we idolize. Whatever is our rock, that is our idol. And empire insists on being the unrivaled rock for every subject, because that's the only way that empire can be at its maximum power, and it has to be at maximum power in order to provide maximum security for everybody. So empire is always, always striving for that maximum conformity and maximum devotion to it. Dissent, therefore, an empire is viewed as, it's not just a bad deed, it's blasphemy. Empire insists on having true believers, and it wants unrivaled devotion. This is why the action of the three was so problematic and had to be severely punished. In general, historically speaking, There have been lots of empires with a small e, that is entities that were striving towards empire with a capital E. There have been lots of empires with small e that have sought totalitarian control of everything to one degree or another, have been successful. I mean, totalitarian control has been the goal many, many times historically, but it's hard to do. So there have only been more recent attempts at empire that have had the technology that's necessary to actually achieve anything approaching totalitarianism. But when that is the goal, when an empire with a small e strives for totalitarianism, that totalitarianism is not tolerated well by a society over an extended period of time. And therefore, in order to make that palatable, the threat level has to be made really high. There has to be some kind of imminent existential threat to a society in order to allow itself to be plunged into totalitarianism. And historically, that has usually been a military threat, an enemy across the border or something that would threaten it. Okay. The second observation I want to make about empire is there is this phenomenon that I think is very interesting, that punishment has a tendency to cease to be proportionate. And here's what I mean. Generally speaking, in any kind of system of justice in a society, if it's a healthy system of justice, the penalties are matched, are proportionate to the nature of the violation. Murder requires a much more severe penalty than does jaywalking. And in any healthy society, the judicial system takes that into account, and it has punishments that are well matched, proportionate to the crime. And in that kind of system, you know what the penalty will be for any given violation. You know what that will be. And there's a sense in which you can kind of decide whether you think doing this risk is worth doing this action, this violation, is worth the risk of the penalty. If I feel it's really important to jaywalk at this particular instance, well, I can take the risk. If I know what the penalty is, I'm going to get fined if I get caught, but I'm willing to run that risk and go across the street in the middle of the block. And everybody knows that if you put disproportionate penalties on things, people are going to be alarmed. If you have the death penalty for someone who jaywalks, that's alarming to everyone. That seems extremely excessive on the part of the powers that be. But in empire, when emphasis is put on complete obedience, when that complete obedience and conformity becomes important, punishment has a tendency, it doesn't always, and certainly not in every case, but has a tendency to evolve into an implement of terror, a tool of terror, that harsh penalties, they instill fear of authorities, and therefore they serve an important purpose in empire. Because fear of authorities becomes an important tool of control. That's one of the problems with a totalitarian society, is that so many resources have to be used to get people's obedience in every little detail that it's just too expensive to operate. And that's historically been the case. But some forms of control are cheaper than other forms. Brute force is the most expensive form of control. So if you can use other things, that's a lot cheaper and more doable. Instilling fear is a lot cheaper than brute force. So if we can just instill enough fear, we can get compliance more easily. So terror becomes an important tool used by authorities. I watched a documentary on the development of Roman crucifixion, and it was really interesting. It was talking about all the steps, how it evolved, and the steps that they went through to develop crucifixion at its kind of perfect form, which was about the time of Jesus. But they were trying to develop a kind of punishment that would be so terrible that no one would dare challenge Roman authority, and they wanted it to be extremely painful, but also very bloody and gory, because that served their purposes better than a terrible punishment that wasn't bloody and gory. And in empire, this kind of extreme punishment for minor wrongs can be justified because disobedience approximates blasphemy. And no punishment can be too harsh for blasphemy. So that's the way it's seen, that's the way it's depicted. And that's the role that it serves. Nebuchadnezzar uses punishment as terror. We've seen it before. It wasn't just in this chapter, we saw it in chapter 2. And that's why the punishments are so extreme. And he was not the only king that did that. Historically, that's been done frequently. In the ancient world, it was done a lot, but it's been done in the modern world as well. It's whenever the justice system, justice is not the primary goal. It ceases to be the primary goal. Control becomes the primary primary goal. And then using punishments as a terror makes much more sense. The third thing about empire that I think is worthy of note here is that there is a symbiotic relationship between empire and snitches. So the Chaldeans were snitches on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And what do I mean by a snitch? It's someone, everybody knows what a snitch is. A snitch is someone who, for their own personal reasons, they want to inflict pain on someone. And so they turn them in because they want the powers that be to inflict pain on this particular individual or individuals for their own personal reasons. It could be jealousy, revenge, hatred, etc. But it's not love of justice. It's not love of goodness. That's not the driving force. The phenomenon of snitches is a common historical phenomenon. It's happened frequently over the years. And there are certain situations, circumstances, which are conducive to snitches. It's whenever people sense that those who are in power want to use terror to control behavior. When they sense that that's the case, that's when you have a rise in snitches, the phenomenon of snitches. Because they sense that the authorities are more interested in making examples of people than they are in justice. So they know that someone who is committing an act that can be seen as dissent, and therefore that person can be used as an example of what not to do, that is, don't dissent, then the authorities are interested. And under these circumstances, the authorities are likely to harshly punish these dissenters, and they are unlikely to investigate it very, very deeply. They aren't really interested in the facts of the case and why the person did what they did, and et cetera, et cetera. They are just interested in the example, the possibility of using this person as an example. So, snitches arise when both the powers that be and the snitches can get what they want out of the deal. And then they proliferate. Two great examples of times when snitches were very active. There were huge numbers of them. The French Revolution and then the Russian Revolution. In both cases, you see this symbiotic dynamic at work between the snitches and the power that be. Unfortunately, it seems to be the case that empire unleashes the worst in people. That's part of what makes empire so ugly. All right, the last thing that I want to point out is that this story, this chapter 3, is primarily about Nebuchadnezzar. I used to think that this chapter was about the three, and they are remarkable characters in this chapter, and exemplary. Yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, if you seriously think about being in their position and doing what they do. It's amazing. Something, unfortunately, I would probably not do. But Nebuchadnezzar is the primary actor in this chapter. He's the one we're supposed to watch. Interestingly, what goes on in the chapter is primarily told from his perspective. One of the commentators that I use, Golden Gate, he refers to this as a conversion story, conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. And he says, in effect, as a result of the act of God, the chapter ends up as a conversion story. The three men do not emerge as individuals in the story, and they themselves give us not account of their experience. The one who gives the account is Nebuchadnezzar. The story is about him. The chapter begins with Nebuchadnezzar as something like a blasphemer and ends up with him as someone who is blessing God, even if it will turn out that he has been only half converted. It is a remarkable transformation that we see in Nebuchadnezzar, even if it is not a complete and lasting transformation. Nebuchadnezzar could have responded very differently. And this is a very encouraging response by him. It seems to me that it's pretty clear that God is working on this individual, on Nebuchadnezzar. This is the second time that Nebuchadnezzar gets a glimpse, at least, of who Yahweh really is. And it has an impact on him. But we'll see next week, he isn't fully converted. He's only half converted, as Golden Gate says. There's more work that needs to be done on him. But God's going to give him a third chance next week. And we'll talk about what comes of that next week. I think it's quite remarkable. Okay, that's all I was going to say. I've got some time for questions, and I see that I have some questions, so I will go through them. Margaret Scholes asked, were the Magi the same as these wise men? As I understand it, yes. That is to say that the wise men, I assume you're talking about the wise men who came to see Jesus. The wise men that came to see Jesus were from the same social class, the same social phenomenon as the wise men that we see here in Daniel. Yeah, it's the same group. Obviously, it's centuries later, but it's the same social group. Ken Jensen asks, why isn't Daniel mentioned with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as not bowing down to the statue? Every commentary I looked at raises that same question. None of the commentaries answer it, I think, adequately. We don't know. We just don't have the data. We don't have any clues as to what's going on. My assumption is Daniel was not present. He may have been away on business or something. But I have to assume that he's just not there. Why is that? I don't know. Why in God's divine, in God's providence, why was Daniel not there? I don't know. Gil asks, is it possible that the statue is an obelisk? Do you know what the significance of an obelisk would have been in the ancient Near East? I don't think it was an obelisk because it refers to it as an image, a tselem. And I think a tselem has to be an image of some creature. So I don't think, I mean, if I'm understanding the word correctly, I don't think that this would be an obelisk. I think it is a statue, and I think it's probably at least inspired by the statue in chapter 2. Gil has another question. Could the chapter 2 vision be a process every empire goes through instead of the process that empire will go through in history? I don't think so. Because I think that what we're supposed to understand from chapter 2 is what is the telos of empire. And empires with a small e don't all reach the telos. The telos will be reached in history, it seems to me. That's my understanding from Revelation and elsewhere, that empire will reach its telos, but that will be at the end of history. But I don't think this is the process that every empire goes through. Gil also asks, can you talk about how we should think about all these warnings against empire as Americans? Whether we're Americans or Frenchmen or Chinese or people all over the world need to understand the dynamics of empire, because the spirit of empire is everywhere there are sinful human beings. And as a result, there is the, when you get people together, there is the inclination towards empire with a capital E. And empire with capital E is oppressive and it's horrible. It's sinful man magnified many times. And therefore, it seems to me that we want to take whatever steps we can to fight against empire, both on small scale as well as, and in ourselves, and on large scale. Jan asked, does it seem that the current crises and we are all in this together slogan is a push towards this collective? I'm inclined to think yes. I don't think that everyone who says we are all in this together is necessarily working towards empire with a capital E. But there is that kind of tendency in all of us, and so given a crisis like this, to move in the direction of realizing more and more of empire. Just coming together to fight a common threat is not necessarily movement towards empire. There have been times when in American history where people have come together in ways that are similar to this phenomenon of empire, people working together closely and making sacrifices for the good of the whole, for the security of the whole. I don't think there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But the question is, what are ambitious people going to do in the midst of that and after that threat is gone? And that what we see historically is America has always pulled together against a common military threat and develop means of accomplishing things during that period. After the threat is gone, it is extremely difficult for those that are in power to relinquish some of that power that they have gained when there was a threat that made that necessary. And so every time we've had a situation where a wartime economy had to be brought into being, that wartime economy doesn't completely get dismantled after the threat is gone. And there are a lot of the things that I have talked about as far as features of empire that unfortunately are being realized in this current crisis. I did my study of Daniel and I wrote my outlines back in the fall. And I have been going through and making some adjustments and stuff as I go along. But for the most part, this is stuff that I was going to talk about before the coronavirus happened. So I'm not making the coronavirus what I'm talking about. But it is amazing to me how a number of these features that I see in empire, as we see it in the book of Daniel, being manifested in events that surround us and with respect to the coronavirus. Okay, we'll call it a day. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. Bye.